It is their duty to trap and destroy any harmful germs that may enter our body. Most of you know that the air that surrounds our body, the air that we breathe in, is filled with all manner of destructive organisms which science calls germs. Some of these harmful germs, when they find a spot that is to their liking, develop and multiply until we have a condition in our body known as diphtheria. Other harmful germs develop and multiply until they show their presence in such number that science calls the condition typhoid fever. That is the story of each and every bodily ailment. The white corpuscles in our blood are constantly on the lookout for such invaders. And our contaminated air brings into our body these harmful germs in countless numbers every time we breathe in. When they arrive in our lungs, and enter our blood, they are instantly set upon by the white corpuscles. And these white corpuscles seek to tear these harmful germs to pieces by digestion. Phagocytes, white cells, great scavengers under the microscope. These white corpuscles in our blood show a ferocity unmatched by any beast of prey. They set upon harmful germs and tear them apart with all the speed and alacrity of a bulldog shaking a rag doll. They hunt in packs like wolves, surrounding the victim and rending it from all sides. Now, as long as these white corpuscles in our blood are kept in the best of condition, so long as their number is up to standard, they are capable of fighting off almost any number of disease organisms that may enter our body. Just remember that. If these white organisms are well nourished, if this little army of defense is well equipped through the food we cat with everything they require for their own purposes, we need have little fear that disease or sickness will gain the upper hand. Yet, if we do not give to our body what it needs to keep this defensive army well equipped and vigorous, if we allow our body to run down, to be undernourished, then these defense battalions of white corpuscles in our blood must fight a losing battle and ailments will follow. Disease is not a cause, it is a result. Disease is nature's way of telling us that something within our body has gone wrong, that the delicate balance of our life processes has been upset. No malignant germ can long survive in a healthy bloodstream. The white corpuscles would destroy it. Food now incomplete. So long as the human body receives everything it needs in the food that is eaten, it retains fairly good health. Despite all the handicaps man, through his defiance of nature's laws, has placed before her, nature continues to fight for our health. So long as man ate good food, food that was filled with everything his body required for its life purposes, nature continued to battle successfully. But man, during the past 100 years especially, has been tampering with his food. He believed he could improve upon nature's handiwork. Men took the wheat as it came from the fields, and to make it look better he stripped it of its skin, which contained many of its most nourishing elements. He extracted and threw away the life element of the wheat, the germ life element which permitted the wheat grain to sprout. He found that the presence of this life element prevented the flour from keeping for years at a time. When he was through, the flour that resulted was a white ghost food with most of its nourishment discarded. But man liked this new flour. He resented going back to the flour made from the whole grain of the wheat, the flour that man had eaten and thrived upon since the days of antiquity. History records that when a New Englander by the name of Sylvester Graham wished to give the people of his community the wholesome whole grain flour of ancient times, the good folk of Massachusetts rose in revolt. Our friend Graham was stoned in the streets, his mill was pulled apart and his home burned to the ground. Man not only devitalized and demineralized his flour, but he refused to eat the sugar in its natural form. He took the juice of the sugar cane, strained it through charred bone filters and removed the molasses. Yet with this molasses went most of the nourishing elements the original sugar contained. The result of this processing was the glistening white powder we have today, another ghost food that has helped mightily to drive good health from the human body. Man peeled his vegetables, and with the discarding of the peelings his food lost many of the nourishing elements nature had stored in this skin and just below this skin to preserve it. Man also cooked his vegetables, throwing away the water in which they were cooked. Man never realized that many of the nourishing elements of vegetables dissolve in water, and that often the most valuable part of his vegetables, from a nutrition standpoint, was allowed to run down the drain in his kitchen. In a thousand ways man tampered with nature's foods. He doctored them. He dried them. He covered them with preservatives. In fact, the dismal story of man's abuse of his food would fill volumes. It is an epic in itself and will go down in history as an unwitting attempt of the human race to commit suicide. Still, despite man's short-sightedness as to his own welfare, nature fought on. She provided him with ample fruits and vegetables that were rich in the essential elements the human body needed for proper nourishment. And as long as man could depend upon this unspoiled source of nourishment, he was able, in a measure, to weather the storm of his own bungling handiwork. Soil now incomplete, but the final straw that broke the camel's back came when man in his selfishness actually destroyed the fertility of the ground in which his food grew. That was the time that even nature was unable to combat the catastrophe. The moment that man had so denuded the good earth that the plants that grew thereon, the fruit, vegetables and grain, no longer could obtain from the soil the nourishing elements that man needed for food, nature seemed to throw up her hands and allow human beings to become overrun with ailments and disease. That is the condition the civilized world faces today. The soil no longer brings forth the bountiful nourishment that nature intended human beings to achieve. This is not the vaporing of swivel chair specialists, the men who tell us how this earth will freeze solid in a few million years. This is not the prediction of crackpot investigators seeking for a momentary basking in the limelight of publicity. It is the sober conclusion of nutritionists who for years have watched with grave concern the despoiling of our lands. The truth of this is reflected in the reports of health authorities and social workers everywhere. So do not regard this statement as a harebrained theory about what may happen sometime in the future. It is a condition that is upon us, a condition that must be faced at once, today. Food loses vital factors. Authorities tell us that there is now a nutrition front in the United States. They tell us that in addition to our other troubles, we must be prepared to fight improper nutrition. They warn us in unmistakable language that much of the food eaten by the American people is poor food. They show by facts and figures that as a result of the widespread ignorance of the laws of health, our physical and mental conditions are lamentable. These same investigators announce that fully 45 million persons in this country are undernourished. Think of it. Here we are, in the richest country in the world, the country that boasts of its millions upon millions of farms, of its wheat and corn fields which stretch from horizon to horizon, and yet, it is now disclosed that fully one-third of our people are actually undernourished. Malnutrition causes rejection of men for army. Now this condition of almost universal undernourishment has been known to many investigators and nutritionists for years. Yet no amount of shouting on their part, no amount of viewing with alarm could rouse the powers that be to a full appreciation of the dangers of such a situation. It took an outside emergency to bring this widespread condition of undernourishment to the foreground. It took the discarding of tens of thousands of draftees to wake this country from its lethargy. For example, during the months of June, July and August 1940, approximately 6,743 men applied for voluntary enlistment in the United States Armed Forces in the metropolitan New York district. These men sought to anticipate the draft. They felt that they were in such fine physical condition that the draft boards would be sure to select them later. Their main reason for volunteering was that they wished to pick the particular type of service which appealed to them. These young men, investigation showed, came from practically every community in this country. Yet of the 6,743 who applied for admission into the ranks of Uncle Sam, more than 2,195 were turned down. More than 25% of the rejected men had defective teeth. Some 21% had defective feet and 10% were deficient in hearing. Lack of weight cut off another 15%, so that the total of rejections was well over 69% on account of so-called minor defects. The remaining 29% of the rejections suffered from various organic disorders. And what happened in New York City is but a sample of what occurred in every recruiting district in the United States. Not only that, but in the operation of the draft itself the percentage of rejections was even greater. And yet, the physical requirements promulgated by the draft officials were in no sense strict. Now, orthodox science could have blamed these unfortunate physical imperfections upon many things. They could have passed the buck. The bad teeth could have been ascribed to the lack of the toothbrush and tooth powder. Ill-fitting shoes could have been blamed for the flat feet. The cause of improper hearing could have been put at the door of the bang, clang and rattle of our modern life. Even the organic ailments could have been made to appear to be a direct consequence of a lack of proper medical care. But science did not pass the buck. Science in unmistakable language accredited these conditions to the almost universal undernourishment of the people of this country. Are we starving at a full dining table? But do not get the wrong idea about this undernourishment. There is no starvation in the general sense of the term in the United States. These undernourished persons are not hungry. There is no lack of enough food. The real lack, the only lack, is enough of the right kind of food. As one prominent official stated, "We in America are living in a land of abundance. There is more food than can possibly be used by the inhabitants of this country. Surely there should be no malnutrition in this land of plenty." But there is. Not only does malnutrition occur here, but it's so widespread that it has come to be recognized as a major health problem. Though it seems paradoxical, it is nevertheless true that a person might eat a sufficient quantity of food and yet suffer from inadequate nutrition. Quantity alone, therefore, is not the solution of the problem. Again, in the same vein, one of the leaders of the United States Public Health Service stated in an article published in a recent issue of the Journal of a prominent medical association, note, this was written before 1942. Without attempting to put any specific figure on the number of people affected, such data indicate that in all probability the nutritional diseases constitute our greatest medical and public health problem, not from the point of view of deaths, but from the point of view of disability and economic loss, a fact about which we have been misled by the very low death rate and inadequate diagnosis. Let us dwell upon these last words, about which we have been misled by the very low death rate and inadequate diagnosis. Now who is responsible for misleading the public? Who is responsible for the inadequate diagnosis? Surely, science has cause to hang its head in shame. That is why the time is ripe, as the oyster in Alice in Wonderland might say, to talk frankly about these matters. The time is most propitious to point out that there are understandable reasons why the majority of the people of this country are undernourished. Calories as heat energy, not enough. For years science has been drilling into the public that each one must receive, in the food that is eaten, a certain amount of energy each day. This energy was calculated by science in the terms of calories. Very elaborate charts were prepared to show just how many of these calories, or heat units, were needed by individuals in various pursuits of life. Oh, the scientists spent plenty of time and much research on this branch of nutrition. They watched their test tubes, estimated the energy required to move our various muscles, and finally emerged from their studies with their charts. Every type of employment has been analyzed. The figures show just how many calories are consumed when you iron, wash, sleep, chop wood or play mumble-ty-peg. In fact, these scientists could tell you to a dot how much energy the body uses to sneeze or gasp. Now if the truth were known, all these calculations were not worth the paper on which their summary was finally written. A calorie is the amount of heat which results when a definite amount of material is burned. And when you read that your body needs approximately 2,500 calories a day, it means that the food you eat should give to your body that much heat. But that it is not its greatest menace. The danger in relying on such a set of figures is that a person eating food containing the prescribed number of calories for a given occupation might be actually starving for the lack of enough proper nourishment. Food that contains large amounts of calories may give energy to the body but may fail to give enough real nourishment to the blood, the heart, the teeth and the bones. The calorie system of nourishment is obsolete, is misleading and in these days of denatured, demineralized, devitalized, processed foods is positively an ominous peril. It should be discarded or amended. In the place of the calorie charts, a new standard of food values should come into being. Nutritionists have realized this for years. A new scale of nourishment values must be made not based on the energy a food is supposed to produce in the body but rather on the amount of real nourishment that a food contains. And the real nourishing value of a food must be calculated not only on the heat it gives but on its mineral and vitamin content. Minerals and vitamins most essential. Most folks know that the body needs approximately 18 different kinds of minerals and some dozen or so different vitamins to properly carry on its work. Now science will agree that it is almost impossible for a person to eat any kind of food that will give his body enough of these minerals and vitamins and not get enough calories for all the energy that person may require. On the other hand, you can eat food containing thousands of calories and not get a single mineral or vitamin, such as sugar. In other words, calories are merely incidental matters. The proper solution of the nutrition problem is to see that your body receives each day everything your body needs for its growth and for the repairing of the parts your activities have worn. The true nutritive value of food must be based on the minerals and vitamins that food contains, not only on the speculative energy it may produce in your body. It is said that 1 pound of fat will give to the body approximately 4,000 calories of energy. And yet, with all this quantity of stored energy, not a mineral, not enough vitamin, is included in that fat. If you would eat fat exclusively, you would die in a very short while of acidosis. Your body must have regularly certain minerals and vitamins in order to keep alive. It should be remembered that each one of these 18 or so different minerals has its important part in the health of a human being. If one single mineral out of the 18 is absent, or if any mineral is present but in too small a quantity, good health is absolutely impossible. Some of these minerals are used in large amounts by the body. The mineral calcium, for example, makes up the major part of the bones and the teeth. Likewise, the mineral phosphorus is used in large amounts. The nerves and the brain are mainly constructed of phosphorus. The mineral iron is used very sparingly and yet it must be present if a person is to have good, rich, red blood. If it is not present in large enough quantities, we are troubled by an ailment known as anemia. If not enough of the iron is given to your body in the food that is eaten, a large gland at the top of your chest, just in front of your throat, starts to enlarge and your trouble is designated goiter. Government and American Medical Association figures show that some 30 million people in this country suffer from iodine deficiency. Every mineral and every vitamin has its proper place in the scheme of things. And not one of these minerals or vitamins should be absent. And yet some of these minerals are found in the body in such minute amounts that they could easily be placed on the head of a pin. Even so, science for years did not appreciate the worth of minerals in the body as they relate to health. For example, science looked upon the presence of many of these minerals in a body as either accidental or unimportant. Science could not see that the mineral fluorine had any particular function. Now we know that if a sufficient amount of fluorine is not present, the calcium, silicon and other minerals in the teeth will become soft. Yet few textbooks mention fluorine at all. The problem of strong teeth is a national one. And whether the universal tooth decay in this country is due to a lack in the food customarily eaten of calcium, phosphorus, fluorine, silicon or some other mineral, science has not yet determined. Like the average committee in a social club reports progress, science says that the cause of tooth decay is still undergoing investigation. Yet explorers and travelers tell us that savage tribes, living entirely on natural foods, have little or no tooth decay. Tooth decay therefore seems to be caused by the lack of something in the civilized human body that it should have received from the food that is eaten, including fluorine. Malnutrition cause of tooth decay. Not long ago, the students of the University of California were examined by a competent board of scientists. This board reported that 95 students out of every 100 had bad teeth, or a total of 95% of something like 5,000 students. It should be remembered that these students at the University of California came from the better class of homes. Now, the average for bad teeth in America is approximately 97 out of every 100, so the students of University of California had teeth that were just 2% better than the terrible average for the entire country. At the same time this announcement was made from California, a most enlightening story appeared in the newspapers. It was the report of two travelers who had just returned from the upper reaches of the Amazon River in South America. These travelers had examined hundreds of the natives of the jungle tribes and had failed to find a single cavity in their teeth. In other words, the chewing equipment of uncivilized natives in South America were perfect as far as upkeep was concerned, while the teeth of civilized Americans are almost universally imperfect. It is widely conceded by nutritionists that tooth decay very seldom, if ever, comes from the outside of the tooth. Brushing your teeth twice a day or three or four times a day will not keep them strong if your body lacks proper nourishment as far as minerals are concerned. And civilized food manifestly lacks these minerals. Good teeth come from good food, right? In point is another late investigation that was conducted by a prominent Philadelphia scientist among the headhunters of South America. Two groups of these savages were studied by this scientist. One group, consisting of 67 men, had never had any contact with the outside world, with our so-called civilization. These men had never tasted civilized food and had depended entirely upon fruits and vegetables as they grow in the tropics. These 67 men, these savages, had perfect teeth as far as the condition and strength was concerned. The second group of these headhunters, 80 in number, had enjoyed the benefits of civilized food for a number of years. And here is the result of these two different types of eating. While the first group of 67 men who lived on natural foods had perfect teeth, the second group of 80, who ate civilized foods, had become dental cripples. Out of the total of 80 men of this civilized food group, 77, that is, all but 3, had bad teeth. While comparing the bad teeth of civilized man with the good teeth of the denizens of the jungle demonstrates a phase of nutritional deficiencies in the United States. Decayed teeth are really a minor manifestation of the ill health of the people of this country. In the medical books are thousands of ailments that might well have as their underlying cause the lack of this or that mineral. I only cite the cases of these savages to bring home to everyone that the cause of this country's universal tooth decay cannot be wiped out by toothbrush or toothpaste. Civilized food must be revitalized, it must have given back to it the nourishment that is missing. I shall later show how this may be brought about. And this goes much deeper than making some improvements in our food processing methods. If the food, as it comes from the field, is actually lacking the necessary minerals and vitamins, no amount of improved processing will make that deficient food good food. Let us not forget that. Food now lacks vitamins and minerals. Lack of vitamins has the same destructive results upon the human body as has the lack of minerals. Of course, vitamins are a new study. They are recent arrivals in the scientific field. More publicity has been given to them than minerals. Yet very few persons understand what vitamins do in the body. Very few persons know why they are essential. A vitamin is not nourishment in the sense that minerals are nourishment. Vitamins do not help build the cells in the body, they do not create the bones, the tissues and the muscles as do the minerals. A vitamin resembles the spark in the engine of an automobile. Without the spark, the gasoline cannot be ignited to give power to the motor. And without the vitamin, the food we eat cannot be properly used by the body. In scientific language, the action of a vitamin in the body is a catalytic one. Simplified, it means a substance which permits two other elements to join together like hormones. Vitamins are just as important as minerals in the field of nutrition, but they serve another purpose. Let me repeat, they are not nourishment. Their presence merely enables the body to take from the food we eat the nourishment it requires, provided of course the food has that nourishment. Many times civilized food is sadly deficient in that respect. And remember, if the food you eat does not contain enough protein and minerals to meet your body's requirements, all the vitamins in the wide, wide world will not give you good health. The old expression that pigs is pigs does not apply to food. Food is not necessarily good food. Not only that, but the character of the same food grown on the same ground changes from year to year. If the nourishment that each crop robs from the ground is not replaced, the food grown on that ground, while it may look exactly like the food that was previously grown, may not contain even one half the nourishment of the original food. Plants vary in minerals and vitamins to the same extent that the ground on which they grow varies in minerals. If there are many minerals in the soil the plants can use, the plants will contain plenty of minerals. If the soil is short on the proper minerals, the plants will grow, yes, but they will likewise be short as far as nourishment is concerned. Poor plants make poor people. Unfortunately, the whole country is eating this type of food that is short on nourishment. The soil has been so ruthlessly robbed that the plants, while they look the same, are all too many times delusions and snares as far as nourishment is concerned. When the first Europeans landed on these shores of the Western Hemisphere, some 450 years ago, they found a continent that was far different from what it is today. The soil was fertile and self-sustaining. The ground was alive with a luxuriant vegetation. Great forests covered the mountainous country, and the heavy spring rainfall seeped into the soft ground and was held there for the hot days of summer. Only on the great western plains were the signs of soil weaknesses. Yet even in that semi-arid region, vegetation grew in profusion along the streams and rivers and wild buffalo grass on the plains. But man is a destructive animal. He thinks first of his own temporary comfort. He gives little thought as to how his short-sightedness will affect the generations to come. So with his axe he denuded the hillsides, and with his factories he polluted the waters of the streams. In a short 4½ centuries man destroyed the balance nature had been building up in the soil for millions upon millions of years. Early settlers looked only at surface indications. They gave no thought to the intricate processes of plant feeding that took place down in the ground beyond their sight. Fertility to them meant crops, and they believed that land was inexhaustible in its ability to give and give without a return to that land of the things of which it had been robbed. In this man made a big mistake. Soil fertility depleted. The fertility of land must come from definite sources, from the minerals in that land and from the nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen and carbon in the air and in the water. If the minerals are there, but not in a form the plants can use, no plant can possibly permanently survive. Men gave little thought to how this air and water was broken up into food a plant could use. He gave little thought to its importance. His analysis showed that plants needed certain elements to live, and as his soil became less productive with each succeeding crop, he supplied chemical minerals to his land in the hope that his seeds would find in these minerals alone the sustenance they required. Only now is man realizing his mistake. Of course, man has paid an extremely high price for his defiance of nature. He had paid, is paying and will continue to pay in ill health for his inability to understand those common processes of nature with which he has so ruthlessly interfered. Civilized man looks with disdain upon the savage in his dingy hut, his lack of sanitation, his failure to see the advantages of the radio, the ice box and the fireless cooker. Civilized man believes that his steam-heated apartment, his running water, his air-conditioned rooms, are far superior from a health standpoint than the rude, insect-infested huts of the Aborigines. Yet civilized man has tens of thousands of ailments, disabling ailments, that fill books as large as an unabridged dictionary. On the other hand, the savage, with all his squalor, could probably count his maladies on the fingers of his two hands.